I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Today, a thought-provoking interview with Professor Flora Kasson, author of the thought-provoking book, Stained Glass, A Reflective History of Anti-Semitism. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. Today is the last day of May, which means that summer's coming up fast. Here in southern Arizona, where I live, that typically means it gets extremely hot, and a good number of people leave town for cooler climes. San Diego or the Pacific Northwest or Park City or Jackson Hole or anywhere the mercury won't climb above 90 degrees, even in these global warming inflected times. Having returned recently from 3 weeks in Southeast Asia, I can assure you dry heat is vastly easier on the system than super humid high heat, which is what you experience there all the time most of the year. But still, 104 degree days, pretty standard experience here in Tucson in June and July, not uncommon in August or even September. Well, that gets old after a while. Yet I must also admit that I personally find the beginning of summer here in Tucson to be quite pleasant in spite of the rising thermometer. Mornings and evenings are lovely, perhaps 70 degrees, really nice. And even when it heats up, and it's supposed to hit 100 next week, if you have access to a pool and have air conditioning in your home and car, it doesn't really affect you that much. And there are some wonderful advantages to June as well. There's almost no traffic here in Tucson since so many snowbirds have flown the coop. The pace of life slows, and by doing your outdoor activities in the mornings and evenings, you can kind of have a homegrown resort experience all month. Which makes this a terrific month, June, to consider increasing your Jewish involvement a bit. For example, during summer months, there are far fewer concerts, plays, events, and festivals scheduled, so why not join us or another synagogue on a Friday night for Shabbat evening musical services, a Sabbath celebration? At Beit Simcha, my own congregation, we always have a delicious Oneg Shabbat after services, basically a full free meal with wine and dessert, as a way to celebrate Shabbat. And we do it all in air-conditioned comfort. Saturday mornings, too, are a lovely way to enjoy indoor spirituality and learning in physical comfort, and are followed by a tasty kiddush. Again, a full free meal with wine. We are Jews, so we always have good food, all in a positive, loving community. I'm not sure that most people think of summer as the time to connect to their own Jewish spirituality, but really, what could be better than listening to great music and singing it if you choose, hearing intelligent and inspirational ideas and thoughts, connecting your soul to God, and meeting and hanging out with smart, interesting people afterwards? That's really what Shabbat in a synagogue is. And you're hereby invited to come join us and find out for yourself this month. To play us in this morning on Too Jewish, here's a lovely Shabbat melody for Lecha Dodi, the welcoming of the Sabbath bride, by wonderful Moroccan chazan, cantor Aaron Ben Susan.
Lecha Dodi, likran kana. Shabbat,
That was cantor Aaron Ben Susan singing Lecha Dodi for Friday night Shabbat services. Come this week, celebrate with us. Celebrate the Sabbath this summer. Our guest this morning, Professor Flora Kasson, explaining the origin and importance of her new book, Stained Glass, A Reflective History of Anti-Semitism. She's from Belgium originally and has a unique and important viewpoint on the rising danger of anti-Semitism today in Europe, in America, and around the world. Professor Flora Kasson is the Levine Family Director of the Brandeis Center for Jewish Studies and director of the Sarnat Center for the Study of Anti-Jewishness at Brandeis University. She has an extensive academic background. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So I studied anti-Semitism in rabbinical school with a wonderful professor, Michael Meyer, Hebrew College in Cincinnati, and we explored sort of the Christian roots of anti-Semitism, but it's more complicated than that. Tell us a little bit about your perception of where anti-Semitism comes from.
I actually think that the Christian origins of anti-Semitism are at the roots of a lot of it. The accusation of deicide, right? Jews being accused for killing Christ and killing God. You know, it's one of the most serious accusations anyone can be accused of. And it's had ramifications for centuries. You know, things like the blood libel or the host desecration accusations in the Middle Ages when Jews were accused of, right, kidnapping Christian children to reenact
the death of Jesus and the use of blood in matzah, supposedly, all of these kind of crazy accusations, right?
Right, too. But sort of the idea behind it is that they were compulsively, you know, driven to reenact. Every generation, every year was compulsively driven to reenact that that crime. And, you know, I think over time, anti-Semitism changed. You know, some of the circumstances changed, some of the, you know, language, the politics changed over time. But I also think that in interesting ways, some of those very early tropes and ideas remained maybe an underlying trend. And, you know, what I think has happened recently is that the Holocaust was in fact driven by a very different kind of anti-Semitism that was right, racial and political, right, where Jews were seen as a separate race and that were a political danger to the European societies where they lived. And of course, because it happened so recently and because the result was so horrible, it is today what we know best. But at the same time, for having studied right earlier versions of anti-Semitism, I've been struck how some of that earlier imagery has come back. And I wonder sometimes if our focus on the Holocaust, which I understand why, because it's more recent, has in a way, you know, formed maybe a bit of a barrier and that many people don't know maybe those older tropes anymore. I think there's some of that going on right now.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. We will talk much more with Flora Kasson. Her book is called Stained Glass, A Reflective History of Antisemitism, including her own experience growing up in Belgium, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. 9999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999999 Tucson celebrates a terrific array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established over 7 years ago by wonderful congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in Northwest Tucson and the Catalina Foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everybody throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for Shabbat services or attend on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary. Call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. Religious school is going great. It's available for school-aged children and grandchildren. Join us in August when we start again with our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience for the youngest kids, confirmation and teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org to sign up. All of our services, classes, and events are open to everybody. Come Friday night. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. in person and on our Facebook page. Saturday morning, Torah study is at 9 a.m. Services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. All of our services are available there and, of course, in person. And all of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and on Zoom. Access those through the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. For more about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school, and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses, and all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or a criticism, a kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18 at gmail.com or visit our website, TwoJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, over 250,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify. Post a rating, review Two Jewish wherever you listen to us. Those comments really help. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Couple of angles into this subject. Just returned myself from a trip to Southeast Asia, and colonialism has had such a profound impact there, but it has had that profound impact nearly everywhere in the world. America is going to celebrate its 250th birthday shortly, which was a colonial war and a rebellion against colonialism by people who were colonists originally.
Right.
Let's start to explore this. And of course, you know, Israel is called a colonizer, which has always fascinated me because to have a colony, you have to have a mother country. And that's like not how it worked there. But let's start exploring this subject.
Sure. It's a vast subject. And I will say that in my own life, I didn't really think when I was a kid that we were once a colony and, you know, how many things we inherited from the Brits. Since we drive on the opposite side of the road, I never thought of us as being an appendage of the UK. But some of my first travels overseas, which were very, in my formative years when I was still a teenager, the first one was I went to Toronto, Canada. And Canada was, at that time at least, and we're talking about the 1960s, much more palpably a former colony of the UK than the US was. It had, you know, accents and words and traditions that came pretty much straight from the UK, and you could feel that Canada was somehow, or Anglophone Canada at least, was a hybrid of US culture and UK culture. And it was interesting to me because, you know, there was the crown attorney and the queen's this and that.
And Dominion, okay. And right, instead right. of state, stuff like
right.
that.
But the next one, which was much more profound, was I spent about 6 weeks traveling all over India, you know, kind of as a backpacker on trains. Nothing was planned, no hotel reservations. And the only reason India has ever worked is because of the British colonial period and the infrastructure that the Brits left behind, you know, in terms of roadways, railways in particular, the civil service, one unifying language for the whole country. And it was, you know, it just hit me like a blow to the forehead. And then a really unlikely one, and we often, maybe Americans just don't know enough about the former Soviet Union, but we don't often think of that as a colonial experience with Russia as the colonizer. However, the first time I visited the former Soviet Union, I flew into Tashkent from Kabul, Afghanistan. And in Kabul at the time, and this was back in the early 70s, so we're talking more than 50 years ago, in Kabul, there were like drainage ditches on either side of the streets, which were filled with raw sewage. It was just running and smelling up the city. And
nice. Yeah.
Most homes didn't have electricity, and the rate of illiteracy was staggering. And that's because, as the Afghanis will tell you very proudly, they were never colonized. So there was no one to do what the French always called la mission civilisatrice, the civilizing mission of white Christian European countries. And then I flew an hour north to what was essentially the same people, the same ethnic group in Uzbekistan. And there were no open sewers. There were no drainage canals along the sides of the street. Every building had electricity, and literacy approached 100%. I think it was like 98.7%. And, you know, the Russians weren't in charge there for all that long, but the Soviet Union could really, or the Russian part of the Soviet Union, could point with pride to their transformations of Central Asian countries, because you could see sort of without colonialism, with colonialism. And there was no question about who was better off. Now, were there antagonisms? Were there people whose identities were deformed or transformed or even stolen from them? Sure. Any profound transformation has to carry some negative consequences as well as positive ones.
You know, and we'll cut it in just a moment and come back to this next week, but that's absolutely a positive aspect of colonialism. We can talk maybe about some of the challenges next time. But I also was thinking, when you mentioned Russia as a colonizer, so many Americans say, oh, you know, we're Russian Jews. But there were almost no Jews in Russia until about the 19th century, when Russia continued to expand westward and kind of took over these countries. And now suddenly all of these Jews were part of Russia. Fascinating, kind of unexpected aspects of colonialism. We'll talk much more next week. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A teenager is at the funeral of his uncle. He goes to the rabbi, who's about to deliver the eulogy, and says, Rabbi, you have experience. Can you please give me the Wi-Fi code here in the cemetery? The rabbi looks at him askance and says, Respect for the dead. And the teenager says, Oh, good, Rabbi. Is that all capitals? That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. Actually, that's kind of a newish Jewish joke, but I like it. And now a word of Torah. This week, our portion, Baha'alotcha, from the Book of Numbers, is filled with a series of incidents and events from the wilderness days, as well as a couple of important mitzvot, commandments. It's in this week's portion that instructions are given to create the first menorah, the seven-branched candelabrum that's become the most enduring symbol of Judaism. It's also here in Baha'alotcha that we get the first rumblings of rebellion, which will explode into full-fledged revolt against Moses and Aaron in just a few more weeks in the disastrous story of Korach. But most significant in this week's portion is a peculiar little story about gossip. Moses has married a new wife, and his brother and sister, Aaron and Miriam, don't think much of her. They begin to talk about her and about Moses behind his back, circulating rumors and gossip. She isn't of the right ethnicity. They don't like her influence on Moses. She probably laughs inappropriately or wears her hair too long. The response from God is swift and decisive. Miriam, although strangely not Aaron, Miriam comes down with a dreaded ailment. Moses' siblings realize the error of their gossiping ways. They repent and are healed. But the point is made. Gossip and slander are among the most destructive influences in society. If we don't avoid them, we will indeed have tsoros, trouble, and heartache. If we can avoid them, we have every chance to build a society based in holiness and good. It's a great message today. As the Talmud teaches, gossip injures three people, the speaker, the listener, and the subject. It hurts the person who gossips, the one who listens to gossip, and the person who is gossiped about. All are morally damaged by the experience, and no one benefits. Circulating rumors, sharing personal information about others, accurate or not, is not the way to create genuine community or intimacy. Lashon hara, the unethical use of speech, is attractive to many, but it is wrong and destructive. There are so many other things to speak about, all of them more valuable. A famous dictum says that great minds speak about ideas, smaller minds speak about events, and the smallest minds speak about others. May we learn from our portion that the best way to use speech is to build and heal and learn, not to engage in gossip. Well, we return in a moment on To Jewish. Our guest, Flora Kasson, an expert on anti-Semitism, explores both the personal and general ways that this pernicious evil has been sustained throughout history, and it continues to grow in our world today. Learn all about it, and perhaps what you can do about it when we come back in a moment on To Jewish.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary from Rabbi Sam Kohan.
One of my alma maters, UCLA, was in the news last week. The U.S. Department of Justice sued the University of California for the second time this year over allegations of an anti-Semitic campus environment at UCLA, claiming the school is deliberately indifferent to the suffering of its Jewish and Israeli students after October 7th. UCLA's Jewish chancellor harshly pushed back on the Justice Department lawsuit, saying its premise was simply wrong. The federal lawsuit claims UCLA violated the students' civil rights by failing to intervene during pro-Palestinian encampment activity in early 2024. This follows an earlier lawsuit that focused on UCLA's treatment of its Jewish and Israeli employees, and it comes 10 days after the university unveiled its own initiative to combat anti-Semitism. Earlier this year, we sued UCLA for subjecting its Jewish and Israeli employees to an anti-Semitic hostile work environment, said U.S. Assistant Attorney General Hamid Dillon. Now the Department of Justice calls UCLA to account for its toleration of the equally appalling hostile educational environment against its Jewish and Israeli students. UCLA Chancellor Julio Frank sharply disputed the suit's claim that the school has done nothing to combat anti-Semitism. Let me be direct. The suggestion UCLA has been passive in the face of anti-Semitism is simply wrong, Frank said. Combating anti-Semitism is a moral imperative, one rooted for me in personal history that makes indifference unthinkable. In the past year alone, we've taken numerous concrete actions to combat anti-Semitism. We recruited an associate vice chancellor for campus and community safety. We reorganized our civil rights office. We appointed a Title VI officer. And we strengthened our policies to protect both free expression and the safety of every member of our community. The new suit draws on widely reported accounts of UCLA's campus environment in the spring of 2024, when protesters in pro-Palestinian terrorist encampments physically attacked pro-Israel counter-protesters, sparking violence and turmoil. The pro-Palestinian terrorist encampment protesters blocked Jewish students from attending classes and exams and harassed them. The failure to protect Jewish students violated their Title VI civil rights, attorneys have said. Citing the report of UCLA's own Task Force on Anti-Semitism, published in response to the 2024 campus disasters, the suit states UCLA's leadership apparently preferred a do-nothing de-escalation strategy instead of protecting their Jewish and Israeli students from an angry mob organized by peers armed with tasers, lumber, and a sword. The Justice Department is seeking several redress measures, including the return of all federal grants made to UCLA during the time of UCLA's non-compliance with Title VI. UCLA has previously resolved several Title VI anti-Semitism cases under the Biden administration, and it also reached a $6.13 million settlement with Jewish groups in a private suit related to the spring 2024 incidents on campus, case that is now cited in DOJ's new lawsuit. The Trump administration has sought to make a particular example of UCLA and its aggressive approach to campus anti-Semitism. Officials tried to levy a fine in excess of $1 billion against the public university for its alleged failure to protect Jewish and Israeli students, but a federal judge intervened. Several Department of Justice lawyers have left the department over its UCLA investigation, telling reporters the case was fraudulent, a sham, and driven by pressure to find evidence to support further legal action against UCLA. That sounds like our current Department of Justice. The campus environment for Jews at UCLA, however, remains tense. Last month, UCLA's Student Senate condemned a campus visit by a freed Israeli hostage, drawing blowback from university regent. In London, two more disturbing events for Jews. The British Museum canceled a lecture titled Ancient Israel and Judah, scheduled to take place last week. The British Museum said the decision was made because it was informed in recent days that a significant proportion of registered attendees were individuals intending to deliberately disrupt the event. That is, kind of domestic terrorists. The event was jointly led by members of the museum's senior curatorial team at the British Museum, alongside organizers from Jewish Culture Month. The lecture was to be presented by Dr. Paul Collins, the museum's keeper of the Department of the Middle East. Jewish Culture Month is the first event of its kind in the United Kingdom. It was organized by the Board of Deputies of British Jews. The festivities open May 15th. They run through June 16th and include more than 100 events celebrating Jewish heritage, creativity, and culture across the UK. Major British institutions are involved, including the British Library, the Tate Modern, Victoria and Albert Museum, and the BBC, all participants. The British Museum said it was only postponing, not canceling the event, stating the decision was a joint one made following conversations with organizers and security partners. The museum added that the decision was made to protect the event, not diminish it. British Museum Assistant Press Officer Lucy McDonald says the museum could not comment on operational or security arrangements, but reiterated the event will be rescheduled to a later date when it can take place in an environment that properly safeguards both the audience experience and the integrity of the program itself. The Board of Deputies of British Jews responded, saying it is highly regrettable that individuals have sought to deliberately disrupt the Jewish Culture Month event celebrating Jewish cultural heritage at the British Museum. At the launch earlier this month, Board of Deputies Acting President Adrian Cohen said the events were designed for Jewish and non-Jewish community members alike because British Jewish culture is not something that exists in isolation. Board of Deputies Director of Culture, Education, and Communities Liat Rosenthal added, "Jewish culture has never been something sealed behind glass. It is a living culture, an argumentative culture." Well, that's certainly true. "A hospitable culture, a culture of memory and reinvention, of stories carried across borders and generations, then remade anew." The museum's postponement of the event is a blow to London's Jewish community, which has weathered a string of violent anti-Semitic incidents since the October 7th, 2023 Hamas attack on Israel. Shimon Cohen, the campaign director for Shechita UK, an organization that advocates for the Jewish ritual of kosher animal slaughter, said, "Why has our country descended into mob rule? Why are we signaling that intimidation, vitriolic abuse, and violence against Jews works? The British Museum can celebrate the contribution of our communities, except the Jewish community," said Cohen. "Instead, their message is clear. Let them cower, be canceled, be exposed through the cowardice of our passivity to ever more hatred. And why? Because Jews don't count." And in other English Jewish news, a huge fire broke out last week at Kosher Kingdom Supermarket in Golders Green, London's heavily Orthodox Jewish neighborhood. Firefighters were still working to put out the blaze many hours later. London Metropolitan Police said the fire was not being treated as suspicious. It was believed to have been caused by an electrical fault. But the incident shook Jewish residents, who have been on edge for months amid a string of anti-Semitic attacks. "We understand the concern and disruption this incident will have caused to the local community and those living and working in the area," police said. "We'd like to reassure residents there is no indication of any targeted or deliberate act." London Fire Brigade Assistant Commissioner Craig Carter said that 15 engines and over 100 firefighters tackled the fire at its height, which has affected a ground floor shop and storage area to the rear, which partially collapsed. "Our specialist fire investigators, in conjunction with the Metropolitan Police Service, have worked fast to establish that the circumstances of the fire are not believed to be suspicious. Investigations on the cause and origin of the fire are ongoing." The news that Kosher Kingdom did not appear to be deliberately targeted is a relief to London Jewish residents. The blaze broke out in the same area where four Hatzolah ambulances were torched by terrorists in March. Two Jewish men were stabbed in April, and a Jewish man was attacked for speaking Hebrew in May. Rachel Cohen lives near the supermarket. Her first thought was that the incident was yet another anti-Semitic attack. Cohen said she looked out the window at 7 a.m. and saw just huge plumes of black smoke. We heard all the sirens and the police roped off all our roads again. Again, Cohen said, it was because she believed it was the third time in 2 months her family was witnessing crime scenes in our neighborhood, that is, Golders Green. The ambulance fire was just on the next street from us, the stabbing situation 100 meters down the road. Cohen said two of her family members previously worked at Kosher Kingdom. They believed from the outset that there was an electrical fire in the freezers because it's exactly from the roof footage that we saw where those freezers are located, she said. Nonetheless, another incident in the neighborhood left her shaken. It's just a bit of a nightmare, really. It's all these incidents adding up and makes it quite scary, this climate of fear we're currently in. It's really oppressive. That's Jewish London today. And in Australia, the head of the Australian Government Commission looking into the Bondi Beach terrorist mass murder attack on Jews reported that witnesses who have testified before the commission have faced an onslaught of online harassment and intimidation. Virginia Bell, head of the Royal Commission on Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion, warned that those who engage in such behavior in Australia could face prosecution. The police have been contacted about at least one case. The former High Court judge made her comments ahead of the second day of a second round of public hearings to assess the timeline and circumstances surrounding the December Hanukkah attack in Sydney that murdered 15 people. We have received reports from a number of witnesses concerning a dramatic increase in online hate messages, she said, adding one of the instances was referred to the Australian Federal Police. Want to make it unequivocally clear, Bell stated, the intimidation of witnesses assisting a royal commission is an extraordinarily serious matter. She added the commission is monitoring, recording, and archiving the posts, noting, we will not tolerate attempts to subvert this inquiry or silence those who have been brave enough to speak. Gillian Siegel, the Australian government's special envoy to combat anti-Semitism, also testified, stating that hatred towards Jews was becoming almost fashionable in Australia. During the December 14th attack, 15 people were murdered, including Chabad emissary Rabbi Eli Schlanger and a 10-year-old girl, and dozens were wounded after two heavily armed, radicalized Islamist men, father and son, opened fire on a crowd of hundreds attending Hanukkah by the Sea at Bondi Beach. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Flora Kasson, whose book Stained Glass, A Reflective History of Anti-Semitism, explores both memoir and history. She is the Levine Family Director of the Brandeis Center for Jewish Studies and Director of the Sarnat Center for the Study of Anti-Jewishness at Brandeis University, has served in other faculties. So you grew up in Antwerp, which is a very interesting Jewish community. Tell us a little bit about how that shaped your experience and about your family's background.
So Antwerp was a very interesting Jewish community. It's a very small Jewish community with about, you know, when I was growing up, about half the people belonged to an ultra-Orthodox Hasidic community, and they live in the center of the city, and they're very distinctive, right, because of how they dress, and they have they live a more secluded life. And then there was a more secular community in the city too, but it was a very close-knit Jewish community in which basically, you know, every grandparent was Holocaust survivor, because, right, it was in Europe. And on the one hand, I think, you know, our lives were, you know, completely normal. We lived like, you know, secular Jews. We lived like, we dressed like everyone else. We did everything like everyone else. And yet at the same time, we also, I describe that in the book, lived a little bit in a bubble, because as far as I can remember, you know, from the early 1980s and on, every Jewish site, every Jewish school, every Jewish event always had to be under heavy protection with, you know, layers of police cars and then policemen and so on. And so that kind of creates a sort of, in retrospect, right, when I was growing up, I thought it's normal. But in retrospect, when I think back, a kind of, you know, ambiguous feeling, because on the one hand, we lived in the city, we spoke the languages, we were Belgian, we felt we were part of society. And then at the same time, over time, I realized that that community could only exist if it was protected. And what does it mean that in Europe, right, 30, 40 years after the end of World War II, Jewish communities can only exist if they are protected by the police, right? And sort of this was something that was completely normal to me. And I only realized after I moved to the United States that, you know, this isn't how American Jews live. I think it's becoming more now today, but, you know, 20, 25 years ago, it wasn't like that. And, you know, in many ways that shaped my views and my questions and has sort of, you know, when I think about the book, driven me to think about in other ways about the resurgence of anti-Semitism that, you know, probably since the early 2000s in Europe at least has consistently been framed as a sort of importation of a Middle Eastern conflict into Europe. And that I'm asking, is that really the correct framework if 20, 30 years before that, Jews already could not live in Europe without heavy protection. And, you know, 50 years before that, there was the Nazi Holocaust. And then you have centuries of, you know, anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic thinking that has found fertile ground in Europe. And so I realized that there was maybe a kind of, you know, comforting myths that emerged after World War II that said, yes, you know, something absolutely atrocious happened to Jews,
right,
during the war. But since the war is over, Europe isn't anti-Semitic anymore.
Yeah.
And whenever something happens, it's because it comes from the outside. Right. And I felt very uncomfortable with that framing.
I think it's not true. You know, it has always impressed me as an American that no matter how much Europe changes, there's something in the very soil of the continent, not to mention, and in England too, that anti-Semitism always regrows. It doesn't need to even have Jews to arise. It's really stunning. America is an interesting case study. You've moved here, you came to understand, and you write about that sort of experience of the freedom of American Jews who don't have to be protected when they go from place to place. Some of that's changed, and there are ebbs and flows. I remember having Leonard Dinnerstein, who wrote Anti-Semitism in America, May Rest in Peace, as one of my first guests on Two Jewish 24 years ago, a long time ago,
which
he said, anti-Semitism isn't, you know, it's a diminishing thing. It's disappearing in America,
right?
Which was, I think, at the time true. It was no longer stylish to be anti-Semitic. You certainly didn't have the kinds of things you're seeing today. Does what's happening today in America impress you as in any way similar to European anti-Semitism?
You know, I think we live in a global moment, and I think the narratives we hear here are very similar to the ones, you know, we hear in Europe, right? That it's all about the Middle East and so on. So I think that's probably one of the factors that makes things different today. And, you know, I often get asked, is America becoming like Europe? And, you know, I'm a historian. I know what I know best is the past, and what I understand how to do is see patterns and, you know, see when sort of some ideas recur, even if the language or, you know, the politics are different, but we see the same symbolism. And I think we're in a time where we see some of those patterns recur and some of those ideas emerge and be powerful in both Europe and America. And in some ways that frightens me. I do feel that structurally America is still different than Europe. because there hasn't been that long history of anti-Semitism. And also because I think, and I mean, maybe that is also changing too. I worry about that. But I think for a long time, America understood itself as a society of, you know, different groups where they have to figure out a way of living together. And it's not always easy. And sometimes, you know, they are in conflict and they don't like each other. But they're trying to work towards a kind of equilibrium where that land can be shared between many different ethnic, religious groups from all over the world, right? And so whereas Europe still very much, even with the construction of the EU that was supposed to be post-national and so on, still very much understands itself as, you know, a product of these national histories. But also I think the American Jewish community is very different than the European Jewish community, it seems to me, in how dynamic and creative it is in reacting to circumstances, trying to make alliances with different groups in societies, continuing to show up even when, you know, things become difficult. Whereas, you know, in Europe, in many ways, the Jewish population is becoming smaller every year. So, you know, we live in a global moment and some trends are everywhere. I still think there are important differences. But of course, you know, what will happen in the future, nobody knows.
In writing Stained Glass, you're really balancing both memoir and then kind of a history of anti-Semitism. You mentioned the awful parade floats in Belgium. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so that was in, I think, 2017, 18.
Yeah, I remember it well.
Before. Yeah, you remember it?
I do.
Yeah, those images were shocking.
Horrific, yeah.
So there's a small town in Belgium where every year it's called Alst. Every year they have, you know, a gigantic carnival parade and you have different groups in the city and every group spends a whole year building a float. And that year, one of the group built that enormous float, which had gigantic puppets that looked like Hasidic Jews dressed in pink. And they were dancing on top of bank safes and money bags. And the anti-Semitic imagery was just so blatant. And that was in 2017, 18. And you know, those images went viral around the world. People complained. And what was, you know, surprising to me is that the people from that town refused to, you know, accept or understand it. Their argument was, this is carnival. We make fun of everything and everyone. If Jews don't understand our humor, then they should just, you know, leave the country. So that was the discourse after that. And you know, it was striking because it was 2017-18. Most of the discussion on anti-Semitism at the time was already, right, all about the Middle East. And yet you see that cultural celebration that thrives on grotesque displays of anti-Semitism that seemed to come right out of the Middle Ages or out of the Nazi era. And, you know, yeah, that just was okay. Jews were blamed. Local Belgian Jewish community was blamed for not understanding it, for not understanding the humor of the country where, you know, they are guests, not where they fully belong. And yeah, it was, I mean, shocking and painful at the same time. And then the year after, they doubled down.
They did it again,
so it
yeah.
It wasn't one big float. But in addition to the float, it's really a big party and dozens of groups dress up. And it was interesting because the Jewish community had complained there's an office for, you know, quality and diversity in Benjamin. I don't remember the name exactly, but they had turned down the complaint saying, no, they are right. This is just humor and, you know, you should understand it. There's no intent to discriminate there. But UNESCO had given the town the title of, you know, one of the heritage of, you know, human culture or something like that, and had threatened to remove that status. And so the next year you had all these groups making fun of, you know, Jews complaining to UNESCO, taking back the status, you had people dressed up, you know, like insects, and they were wearing, you know, big black hats and had side locks like Hasidim. So it was very offensive. And it seemed, you know, like a party they reveled in. And, you know, it's true that Carnival is about making fun of everyone and everything. And at the same time, we also all understand that some topics are very sensitive. And we try to be sensitive to, you know, groups that have historically been discriminated. And in this case, there was just a complete refusal to do that. And yeah, that was disappointing.
Horrific. I want to go a little bit more obscure. You know, we think about the expulsion of the Jews from Spain taking place in 1492. You're an expert also in northern Italy. But the last Spanish expulsion you wrote about, tell us about that, because it's, 70 years later, 80 years later. It's incredible.
Yeah, so 1597, or just...
Almost a century, more than a century later, sorry.
Well, yeah, I was actually, I wrote my first book and I did my PhD on the history of Jews in northern Italy. And so I did a lot of research in Milan. And Milan has a small Jewish community of around 900 people in the 16th century. And what's interesting is that at some point, Milan becomes part of the Spanish Empire. And so even though Jews had been expelled from Spain and could not, you know, technically live in Spain or in the Spanish Empire, suddenly you have a situation in which a Spanish king, in this case Philip II, becomes the king of a Jewish community again in Milan. And what I found when I was in the archives was that for 30 years, there was a debate about what to do with the Jewish community of Milan. And I have some handwritten letters by Philip II himself, where he's asking, you know, what should we do about the Jews? How many are there who live there? What is the situation? And so on, where he's, you know, saying, well, you know, really they shouldn't be there, but they are there. And so that was a whole... discussion and debate, and eventually they get expelled. I think there is even a later one, but that is in North Africa, in Tunisia, where there also was a Jewish community, and I think they live even longer under Spanish rule, but then eventually get expelled.
Also
well.
Expelled.
But that was the last one in Europe.
Last one in Europe was in Milan.
That's what I wrote about. And so in that article, I sort of detailed that 30 years long back and forth between the Spanish king, the authorities in Milan, the Spanish authorities in Milan, the local authorities in Milan, the Jews sometimes get involved. Yeah, it was an interesting project to work on.
I want to thank Flora Kasson for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her book, which is excellent, is called Stained Glass, A Reflective History of Anti-Semitism. Where can people go to find out more about you, to find out more about the book?
So the book is available, you know, online. I think on all the web pages where they sell books, whether it's Amazon or the web page of my publisher, the University of Toronto Press, or you know, bookshop for people who want to prefer independent booksellers. So yeah, the book is available everywhere right now and can be purchased.
And if you want to find out more about her, it's florakasson.com, FloraKasson.com. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Join us next week for another great edition of Too Jewish. Our guest will be Nathaniel Popkin, author of a new novel on tension over Israel in synagogues today called Partly Strong, Partly Broken. Please join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in air-conditioned comfort every Friday night. Services in Oneg Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading, and Kiddush in person and on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for service and class schedules and sign up for our new Torah Tykes membership for the youngest among us. Our playout this morning here on Too Jewish comes from the Barcelona Gypsy Klezmer Orchestra, playing their lovely version of Havenu Shalom Aleichem. My friends, may you have a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Too Jewish is sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.